I'm Eilif Trondsen, the project leader of the Nordic EdTech Network project funded by Nordic Innovation. And today I have the honor and pleasure of interviewing Alison Baum, managing partner of Fresco Capital. She's located in Tokyo, Japan, so we are using Skype, and I hope the technology will be kind to us and give us great audio quality, at least for the next 30 minutes or so. I had the great pleasure of meeting Alison in a coffee shop in San Francisco some months back, and I'm sure that all of you who listen to this podcast will be fascinated about Alison's journey and current activities, as I was when I heard her story and learned about her EdTech passion. I'm very happy that you agreed to the interview, Alison, and we are, if we're lucky, perhaps we can persuade you to come and join us in Kristiansand for the conference next year so that many of our Nordic friends can meet you face to face.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So let me start by welcoming you to the Nordic EdTech Network podcast series. And the first question, I think it would be good if you could maybe add to a few things that I said about you and add some details on your experience after graduating from Harvard and how you got into the world of technology startups and then getting into venture and edtech investing.
Absolutely. So after I graduated from Harvard, I ended up going to work at Goldman Sachs in New York. So started my career on the trading floor, doing sales and trading on equity derivatives,
okay,
which was always a good conversation killer at cocktail parties.
Now that's a fast tech world, a fast speed world, isn't it?
Yeah, it was crazy and a lot of fun. I learned a lot. I spent a couple years doing that and then at some point started to get what I think is that typical millennial dissatisfaction with being in a role where you're not creating anything new. So, you know, spent every day kind of trading these financial products and ended up wondering after a while, why am I doing this? What is the point? And for a long time thought that I was special because they had picked me out of these thousands of applicants. But what I realized is what that actually meant is if I weren't sitting in that seat doing that job, someone else would be doing it and nothing would be any different. So I started to think about what I could do where I could see more of a tangible impact and I could create something that didn't exist before. And the clear answer was doing something in technology and startups. And so then I went out and I started talking to all of the tech startups in New York at the time. And I was interviewing and trying to figure out where I fit in. And when I had decided to go to Harvard and when I ended up at Goldman, I knew these weren't necessarily things that mattered a ton in and of themselves, but I thought that maybe having that brand or that background, I could it would award me opportunities in the future. Right. And I think I had a pretty rude awakening when I was speaking to all of these startups and I said, yeah, I graduated from Harvard, I work at Goldman Sachs, and everyone said, I don't care. They said, good for
you. Can you program? Can you?
Yeah, exactly. Good for you. But if we're going to hire you, we need you to build us an app or design our user experience or do our digital marketing strategy. And I didn't have any of those skills and I actually didn't even really know what any of them meant, to be honest. If someone said, oh, we need a front-end web developer, I had no idea what that meant. So it was, you know, an interesting time. But the first time I really saw the real gap and the very quickly widening gap between what traditional education provides and what the job market is demanding. And so it was at that time that I came across General Assembly, which initially started as a co-working space in New York, but the founders soon saw the same gap in that the startups working out of their space needed to hire people with these skills. They were looking for digital marketers, user experience designers, and primarily developers. And even though unemployment was at record levels in the U.S. at the time, they couldn't find these people. So they saw a clear market need and said, okay, well, let's train them. And that's when I met them and ended up coming on board to help produce their part-time and full-time programs to train professionals in these digital skills.
Right.
So we launched their first part-time and full-time programs in New York, which was an awesome experience. And then I ended up going to Hong Kong on vacation. And I was learning throughout this process that I'm also a fairly early stage person. I love making things happen, doing, you know, figuring out how to create something out of nothing and making it work. And once you have a roadmap, I think it's a different mentality that you need. And so I was really loving that early stage. And we had sort of done that in New York. And I was thinking about what's next for me, what's next for General Assembly. And I was in Hong Kong and I saw the exact same ingredients that made General Assembly such a success in New York. So there was a strong need for developers. There was a falling an education, very traditional education system that was falling behind. And there were a lot of dissatisfied millennial workers in these corporate roles and law firms and banking. And so I started doing some research and thought that the model would work very well in Hong Kong and even better in Asia more generally, because I think we'll talk about this a little bit later, but there's a big opportunity to build direct-to-consumer education businesses in Asia, which can be very difficult in the U.S. and in the West. Mm-hmm. So I went back and I pitched the founders and I said, hey guys, if you want to be a billion-dollar education company, you really need to be in Asia. And they thought I was completely insane. They're like, you're not Asian. We don't understand why we would do this now. It wasn't really on our roadmap. But I was somehow able to convince them. So I moved out at the end of 2012 and launched General Assembly in Hong Kong, which was an awesome experience. Hired a team. It was really the first education of that kind in Hong Kong at the time. And I think certainly served as fuel for the startup ecosystem there. Mm-hmm. And then through that process, met my two partners at Fresco Capital, which is where I am now. Both Steve and Titus were in Hong Kong at the time, and they had also built cross-border businesses. And what we really connected on was this idea that, you know, the biggest and most exciting world-transforming startups have to expand globally. But that's not an easy thing to do. And startups are often incentivized and motivated by the demands of their investors. And so we felt that if companies are going to truly take advantage of global opportunities, they need to have investors on their team who are thinking in that way from the very beginning.
Right.
So most early stage investors are very, very local, which is very important. And we always want to work with these people. But the experience in the perspective that we can bring is one which is global, of entrepreneurs who have built cross-border businesses ourselves, and we know what it takes, and we have that network and set of resources that we can then lend to our portfolio companies. So that's what we do at Fresco Capital, and I'm now based in Tokyo, and working here to help our portfolio companies take advantage of opportunities in Japan as well as the rest of Asia, and also work with our strategic investors in the region.
Great. I know we share an EdTech passion, Allison, but I'm of course located here in Silicon Valley and focusing quite a bit on the Nordic area, and you sit in Tokyo, and you therefore have a close look at what is happening on the Asian front. An area of the world that I think intrigues many of our Nordic EdTech players, but I really don't think many of them know a great deal about the region in terms of EdTech opportunities. So perhaps you could share a little bit on what you see, especially in Asia, but secondly, because you take such a global perspective and are globally active, what is happening in the global arena as well, and then how that has influenced your EdTech portfolio choices.
Yeah, I mean, part of emphasizing Fresco's approach is worthwhile in that we believe in investing in companies that are solving global problems, and then we help them with local implementation. So when it comes to EdTech, our view is that the problems that technology can help solve in education are actually relevant anywhere in the world.
Right.
However, what that business should look like or how you can grow your business in certain regions happens to be very different.
Right.
So our approach, we look at what problem the company is solving, and there's four problems that we think technology can solve in education. One is increasing access to content. The second is improving efficiency and operations. The third is improving outcomes through personalization of content and pedagogy.
Right.
And the fourth is providing job-relevant skills. So those are challenges everywhere in the world. But again, particularly in Asia, your business might have to take a little bit of a different form. So I would say there's three key themes that we've seen emerge in the region here that affect how we advise our portfolio companies to adapt, as well as what kind of companies we're looking at coming out of the startup ecosystems in Asia. So one is that there's a tremendous opportunity for B2C education companies in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
In the US, and I think this is largely true in Europe as well, if you're going to be a $1 billion company, you want to be selling, you basically have to be selling at a systemic level, which means you have to be selling governments or businesses. In Asia, however, the market size is gigantic, and there is a propensity to spend money on education products at the individual level. So just looking at the US, for example, there's 30 million K through 12 students, but there's 600 million K through 12 students in Asia.
Yeah.
And the average family spends 40% of their income on education.
Enormous. Wow.
Yeah. So I think there's a really big consumer opportunity. Not that that's easy, but that's certainly different than in the U.S.
Right.
So the second is the opportunity for language learning companies.
Right.
I think in Europe and the U.S., there's a lot of interest in learning English or interest in learning other languages. I would love to be better at Spanish or something, but there isn't necessarily an imperative market need.
Right.
But in China, for example, learning English can improve your yearly income by 30 to 50%.
Hmm.
And the market size there is huge. I mean, there's more people learning English in China than there are native English speakers in the United States. So that's an area that we're looking at quite closely. It's very, very competitive, but a big opportunity if someone's able to get it right.
Right.
And the third piece or the third trend that we're seeing, which I think is true everywhere, but particularly true in Asia, is the shift to mobile.
Mm-hmm.
So actually 60% of the world's mobile phones are in Asia. Mobile penetration is very high. In places like Hong Kong, it's even 200%.
Wow.
So people are, and on top of that, I think consumers in Asia are accustomed to doing everything on their phone because they often don't have access or simply don't want to access the internet through a personal computer. They're doing it completely through platforms like WeChat or just anywhere on their phone. So that's something we see as a really big opportunity from a technology perspective, is being able to build a mobile first product is very interesting to us.
Yeah, that particularly your last point there is quite relevant and quite interesting for the Nordics, because as you know, the Nordics have been focused on mobile technology for a long time. Maybe partly because of Nokia's role in that industry, but I think the Nordics in general have been very keen on mobile. And I know a number of the edtech companies that will be at the conference in Kristiansand are in fact focused on mobile delivery, on micro learning or nano learning on mobile devices. But to follow up some of the incredible statistics in terms of the size, they're fascinating. And this is where the Nordics are so different, because they're small countries. I was curious about the differences in terms of how companies scale then, because of the enormous numbers of students and or companies that are being served. So that is a probably significant difference. between, you know, the U.S. and Asian edtech companies in terms of having to deal with and serve that many customers?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think in some ways this has led to a legacy system of corporate domination in Asia. So because achieving scale is often directly B2C, whoever has more marketing resources tends to win.
Right.
So even in Japan, you know, people often ask me about the edtech ecosystem in Japan. And honestly, the most successful edtech company in Japan is this online tutoring platform called Juken Sapari. And it was developed and pushed out by one of the largest companies, publicly traded companies in Japan called Recruit Holdings. And their core competency is marketing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is good in some ways, but also challenging for startups who are looking to break into a market where they maybe just don't have the resources to outbid large companies for some of those customers.
Right. If you look at the public and private sector players, you know, particularly in the Nordics, I think a lot of the startup companies are focused on, you know, schools and therefore public policy and governments play a large role. Although I personally think there are lots of really interesting opportunities in corporate learning as well that are often ignored as edtech players focus just on K through 12. So do you see any interesting developments in those areas in Asia as well?
Yeah, there's, I mean, I think from a government perspective, Asia is pretty fragmented. So there's two types of approaches depending on the market. There's top-down approaches where you clearly just need places like Singapore. If you're able to get government support, you will almost surely be successful there.
Right.
And then there are other places where you really, you know, it's much more of a bottom-up approach. So freemium models work well, and working through more of a consumer-facing model is useful. China is its own beast when it comes to the government. A lot of startups are targeting international schools because it allows them to circumvent having to work with government schools. And that's certainly a big market. International schools are willing to spend a lot per student.
Right.
But there are also, you know, only so many of them.
Okay. Well, if you look back, Allison, you know, what are some of the most interesting developments that you've seen in edtech and now taking a global perspective, and you've been active all over the area. So if you look back 3 to 5 years, let's say, and then ahead in the next 2 to 3 years or so, what kinds of changes do you think our Nordic friends should really pay attention to and it's interesting, many of the Nordics, they think globally pretty early on, and so they'll be very interested in how you see things and what they should pay special attention to as they lay their global plans.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because at Fresco, you know, I focus on education technology, but we actually invest across sectors.
Mm-hmm.
And we have an education kind of strategic fund, which is focused purely on that. But then our second largest sector is enterprise technology. So this falls under this thesis of what we call how tomorrow works. And what we're looking at is how is the workforce changing? How is the generational shift and the shift in technology contributing to a change in how companies work, what jobs are available, and what kind of skills are required for those jobs.
Right.
And many people hear about our sector focuses and they think they're so disparate. They're like, oh, enterprise technology is so different from education. But it really isn't. And if anything, I think it's a really important leading indicator for what needs to change in education.
Right.
Because ultimately, the point of education is to get a job.
Yeah.
Right? So
that is true.
If you look at the shifts happening in the enterprise, that's a really important place where you can see how education ultimately should shift. So the shift to digital jobs, the proliferation of AI, seeing how a lot of these low-level, white-collar jobs that used to give people very stable life paths are now being automated. And so I think that immediately creates a need for professional ongoing education.
Right.
And then I think ultimately will trickle down into higher education and K-12 as well. Of course, there might be a shift in the need, but the near-term catalyst has to be a change in government policy. So I think the other trend that we're watching very closely, and has started, I really commend the U.S. for moving quickly on this, but STEM policies,
right,
for schools. And so there's more coming in Asia now. Japan's starting to wake up to it. Malaysia has been doing a lot, but actually requiring, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math courses in schools at the K-12 level is something where I think is going to be important to watch going forward.
Yeah, it's I think it's really interesting to see some of the things that are going on in that arena. And I just a week ago, I saw a notice about a meeting that actually the San Mateo County Office of Education put on, and Oracle was a main sponsor and put up the funding for the event. And it was kind of, they were looking at the convergence of the maker movement and what is happening in learning, and how kids now can, you know, learn more by doing things and making things and so on. And I thought it was really interesting. They had an overflowing crowd, more than 500 people attended. So wow. I'm going to be talking a little bit about that in the Nordics, and I'm curious whether that is taking off also in the Nordics. But I think it's really, really an interesting element of the kind of STEM movement. So, but I want to switch a little bit and talk a little bit about funding and so on, because I came across an interesting report recently by CB Insights. About a month ago, I think it pointed out to the slowdown in the first quarter of 2016 for EdTech investments, and I think that followed a downward investment trend in the tech sector in general, especially here in the U.S. But then, just last week, I saw a note that Udemy, here in the Bay Area, got an investment of $60 million from a South African media and internet giant. So it seems that it's possible to still raise significant edtech capital even if the overall market is cooling off a bit. And I was kind of curious as to how you see the situation, particularly in Asia, and where you think we're heading.
I definitely think early stage investment in ed tech has gotten a little bit crowded.
Right.
You know, I think the challenge has always been at the seed stage. There's seed funds that I think are actually, like ourselves, who are best equipped to evaluate potential opportunities. But there's also a lot of angel investors that get very excited about education and maybe don't know the market as well. And they end up funding companies that maybe have a great mission but aren't very clearly innovative or differentiated.
Right.
And so what's happening is now those companies are going to raise seed extensions or Series A and having trouble. And so we're starting to see some evolution of the maturity of these companies, and some clear winners have evolved. And that's where you're seeing kind of these larger investments happening in companies like Udemy or Newton. Edmodo has been very active in raising capital in Asia. And I think we're, so, and even in China, you know, a lot of, you see these incredible headline numbers of how much money has been invested in education companies, but a lot of those are $100 million plus deals that are getting done, and that's accounting for a lot of those numbers. So I think over the next year or two, we're going to have to see some positive outcomes for these larger education companies, like, you know, even a General Assembly, which raised, you know, $70 million plus Series D or C last year. We're going to have to see what happens. Will they IPO? Are they going to actually be successful? Will they be acquired? Because once you get to that stage, there's fewer potential outcomes for you.
Right.
So I think we'll have to see what happens, but that will be pretty critical in terms of how the early stage market develops as well, because if there are big outcomes for those companies, I think we'll see a lot more generalist funds start to get into the education sector, which has already started happening, but I think that will accelerate. If they turn out to be negative outcomes, then it might be a little bit tougher going forward.
Right. Well, I don't want to take too much more of your time. You've been very generous with your time. And the last question, kind of following on some of the things we talked about, and you have looked at hundreds of companies over the years in various parts of the world, and I was curious about what some of the things are that you can kind of share with some of our Nordic edupreneurs that I will be with next week in Kristiansand. So, you know, if you look at either operationally or kind of strategic lessons learned, what are some of the things our Nordic friends should think about as a plan ahead for the next couple of years and perhaps try to enter the global stage? What are some of the things they should maybe avoid or things that they could learn from some of the companies that you have looked at?
Yeah, I think I have one piece of general advice and then one, I guess, specific point of view from a Fresco perspective. When it comes to education and ed tech, one of the reasons why I love it so much is because it's very complex and there are a lot of emotions entangled in it. You're definitely formed by your own experiences, and those taint what you think is possible. You know, education, learning, it's all very aspirational and inspiring and emotionally engaging.
Right.
And I love that, but I think it means that a lot of people are afraid of looking at the stark reality of how challenging education is and how it can be largely ineffective and difficult, and people don't do things unless they have to. So I think one of the biggest mistakes that education entrepreneurs do is they build products for people that are like them, people right. that love learning. And not everyone loves learning. Or they love learning in theory, but they don't actually follow through on that.
Right.
So I think my advice is to be very practical and pragmatic about the product you're building. Is it absolutely necessary? And is it actually different? There are a lot of early stage companies that are just nice to have and not need to have, and even more that are just not even really that innovative. And so I think that's my biggest piece of advice is, while I'm sure there are a lot of great things about what you're building, you know, you have to ask those hard questions at the early stage.
Right.
And the second piece of advice I would give, and it sounds like this is a core strength of your community, is to be thinking globally. You know, there are so many, if you want to build a really big education company or a big technology company, just generally speaking, being prepared to expand outside of your home market is going to be critical to your success at the later stage. I mean, you brought up the example of Udemy taking this investment from a South Africa media, an internet company. You know, a lot of the later stage investment, and eventually I think a lot of the acquisitions that we're going to see over the next few years will be cross-border. And so getting out there, being on the global stage, making sure people are aware of you, even before you decide to actively expand, I think is going to be very important.
Right. Yeah, that's very good advice, Allison. I really appreciate it. And I certainly will share your insights with our friends when I meet them next week. And it's unfortunate you can't be there, but we're going to work hard to try to get you over there next year. So I know your day is just starting, and hope you have a great Friday and have a good weekend.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for participating. Bye.
Bye.